It certainly is a great, great honor to be welcoming Antonio Lobo Antunes here. So a warm welcome from everybody. My name is Paul Holden Graeber, and I am the Director of Public Programs here at the New York Public Library, now known as LIVE from the New York Public Library. Many of you know that my motto used to be to make the lions roar. This year we've changed it, and it's expect wasabi. So we've had quite a lot of wasabi already. Last week we had Bernard-Henri Lévy and Slavoj Žižek. We had Daniel Mendelssohn and Pico Aya and James Wood, then Robert Badinter. Today we have Antonio Lobo Antunes. I highly encourage you to join our email list so you might find out about other upcoming events. We will end the season with an interview I will be doing of Daniel Barenboim. Before that, Zadie Smith, and many other goodies you will want to hear about, I'm sure. At the end of this week, on Friday, I will have the pleasure, I hope, of interviewing Spike Lee. So do join our email list and come and join our live events here. After the conversation with Antonio Lobo Antunes, which will last, as I often say, about as long as a psychoanalytical session, so somewhere around 50 minutes, you will have occasion to ask questions. We will pass the microphone around, and I ask you that you ask questions rather than make very lengthy statements. 192 Books is our book provider, and Antonio Lobo Antunes will be signing books after the event. It is now my great, great pleasure and privilege to bring here someone who can do a real introduction to Antonio Lobo Antunes. That is the executive editor, Bob Weil of Norton. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. I'm delighted to give this introduction to this evening's event for Antonio Lobo Antunes, which marks his first publication in the English language in 6 years. We're all very grateful to the New York Public Library and Paul Holden Graeber for hosting this evening's event and for celebrating a writer of such international stature. I have to comment that Paul has been after this writer for years now, and he sees my list of books, and he has been visionary in saying he wanted Antonio as a speaker and a panelist for many years, and we are truly grateful for his support of serious literary works. I thought that a good way to preface these short remarks is to discuss my own involvement with Antonio's writings, the first being the publication of this novel, What Can I Do When Everything's on Fire, which is being published this month, as well as the publication of his shorter essays, known in Portugal as Crónicas, which will appear from Norton in hardcover next February. This fall marks my own 30th anniversary in American publishing. And I've seen, I think, enormous changes, particularly with a larger culture, which, despite the intervention of the New York Public Library Speakers Program, often seems to have jettisoned a deep interest in serious books, literary fiction, especially fiction in translation. All my career, I've made a concerted effort to find and aggressively publish great literature from abroad. And despite the consensus that foreign literature does not sell, my success record with authors like Lobo Antunes, others like Primo Levi, Heinrich Bill, Joseph Roth, Isaac Babel, Pavel Kohut, and although he writes in English, but he writes about everyone foreign, the inimitable Clive James, who brought down the house here 2 years ago, suggests just the opposite. I was, of course, familiar with Lobo Antunes' fiction for many years, and I had read South of Nowhere, first published in 1983, to novels like The Inquisitor's Manual and The Natural Order of Things. So I jumped when Antonio's agent, Tom Colchi, who is seated right here, renowned, really renowned for his own advocacy of great Spanish, Portuguese, and Latin American writers, many of them who are all household names, suggested that I pursue the rights to this novel in 2003. Since I, as an editor, cannot read all these foreign languages, I must rely on a few well-trusted people to recommend the right books that are, or we hope, approximate literature. And in this case, we all as a community are grateful to Tom Colchi and his wife, Elaine Colchi, who have literally created on their own, through their passionate personal recommendations, an entire body of Latin American and Spanish literature that appeals to Americans. Antonio says that Tom has a quote-unquote nose, which is indeed true, and he does what no mere agent can do. Also encouraged by a glowing recommendation from Harold Bloom, who loves Antonio's work, as well as by Henry Finder, the editorial director of The New Yorker, who told me that he deeply admired the work, we came to terms 5-6 years ago with Colchi, and we were fortunate enough to get the esteemed translator, Gregory Rabasso, who's sitting here right to my left, who's translated 100 Years of Solitude and many other great works, to agree to do this translation. What I didn't realize is just what a challenge it would be for Gregory. So we've worked together in one way or another for 5 years, through several drafts, before the unedited final draft was ready for editing last summer, 2007. Paul asked me to speak a little about the whole process of translation. So I'll just, some of the background. We signed this up 6 years ago, so my excitement and impatience increased because Antonio is winning one literary prize after another. The Jerusalem Prize in 2005, the Comomesh Prize in 2007, and just 2 weeks ago he won the Phi Prize, given in Guadalajara at the end of 2008 in November, which for $150,000, which is the first time the prize has ever been given to a non-Latin American author. So last summer, I was finally confronted with this manuscript, then being 1,200 pages of triple-space translation. And at first, I was a little startled just by the size of the work. And I kept lugging around these pages, just not confronting them, until I finally delved into the second draft at end of July, beginning of August. And I found myself, I have to be honest, literally blown away, like no other work of fiction I've ever worked on before. And I've edited Henry Roth, the great modernist Wolfgang Köppen, and many others. Suddenly, I found myself really almost mindlessly chattering to literary friends and colleagues that Norton might have on its hands, permit me as an editor to be hyperbolic, a Portuguese Ulysses. This being the new novel, What Can I Do? Miraculously, out of what can seem at first like an incomprehensible hubbub, there emerge complex characters, a powerful sense of place, and the thread of a gripping story, says Margaret Joel Costa, who's translated the next work. But editing a translation is never easy, and specifically this translation, which often reads like poetry. So in a Kerouac sense, so the best one can do as an editor is not to know the original language, but to listen for the correct idiom, the cadence, the word order, the rhythm, and to help the translator come up with the version which approximates the original as much as possible. We also urge Gregory to do a dramatis personae and a map, which aren't in the other editions, which will make things, I think, much more a compelling read for readers. Based on the real-life story of Ruth Bryden, a Lisbon transvestite known as the Queen of the Night, a neglectful father turned flaming queen who dominated the nightclub scene of Portugal in the 1990s, What Can I Do When Everything's on Fire is in fact largely narrated by the drag queen's son, Paulo, who chronicles the splendor and sprawl, the seediness and the sexual misadventures of his father and his father's lover, the heroin junkie Rue, until Paulo too realizes at the end of the novel that he may too be drawn to the rustle of lace and the fateful cologne that so entranced his father. If Paul asks, maybe you'll hear how Antonio came to this story. But along the way, we're treated to dizzying parade of flamboyant characters, decrepit family members, foster parents, extended aunts and uncles, dead children, more drag queens, brutal nightclub managers, and faithful Johns who create something of a grand opera that records the momentary joys and the agonizing lows of those race and souls in down and out Lisbon. In short, the flotsam and jetsam of collective memory and human consciousness. I use the word opera deliberately, for me, reading Lobo Antunes, and I love the opera, is like really getting into Wagner. Some people will never get into Wagner and say they hate Wagner. But once you get into Wagner, you cannot forget those rhythms and the leitmotifs of speech. And that really is, for me, this sort of explosion in my head, as if, you know, the pleasure receptors of my overloaded brain were stimulated by this language. Sometimes I have to say I thought I was in Eliot's Wasteland, so phantasmagoric were the poetic tropes, the mastiff barking at the waves, the dwarf from Snow White on the refrigerator, the dead sister Noema with no eyes, no face, reduced to a bicycle with flat tires whose silence was growing in the dust, her skinny legs, a stack of school books, a broken pencil sharpener. And at other times, I felt this was a piercing meditation on the varies and permutations of the human condition, a saga of growing old, of loving no matter what, and finally, yes, the resolved narrative of young man ineluctably coming to terms with the sins of his father and the life he has inherited now. 1 year after the editing, I have to admit, even unashamedly, I really want to go back to this novel. I want to read it again as a non-editor. And something people said yesterday at an event at NYU, which I think informs him, there's such an understanding of humanity and goodness and just the, you know, somehow in a very, just the goodness of people comes through that, you know, what is this? To encounter the paradise of the pure heart, the homosexuals, addicts, depressives, transformists, lesbians, and lonely people who'd lost their ideals 35 years ago. Antonio gives life and dignity to these people who lost their ideals 35 years ago. And I think you'll hear some of this as I hand the microphone and the conversation over to Paul Holdengraber and Antonio Lobo Antunes. Thank you very much.
I hope this will not prove to be true. But you have said, if I'm not mistaken, I am incapable of talking about myself, and even more so of talking about my books. I have not read them, I have only written them. Is that so?
Is that so? But first of all, if you permit me, it's a pity that publishers a little bit all over the world are not here, because the words of Bob Weil are an example of what a publisher must be, an example of honesty, of talent, of love to books. So I was very moved by your words, Bob. Very, very moved. It was a lesson for me. I was learning when you were speaking. And if you permit me, I would like to make my homage to Greg Robasso. We know each other since more than 20 years, him and his wife, Clem. And he knows how much I admire and I love him and how much I respect him. And also to Tom, Tom Pulci. You know, in 1709, when second book came in Portugal, I received a letter from an agent, an American agent, saying that he wanted to be my agent. And I didn't believe that. I thought it was a joke, kind of, it couldn't be, but a joke. Then I didn't answer, and he sent a second letter, and I said to myself, well, it's chic to have an agent in New York. So we started working with Tom, and
why didn't you believe it?
Pardon?
Why didn't you believe it?
I was a beginner. It was the second book was coming, had coming out. And miraculously, he received it from a Brazilian writer, Márcio Souza, who went to New York, he gave the book to Tom. It began like that. And friendship is like love. It's you met someone and you become a childhood friend. And Tom was much more important than you may think, because every week we talked by telephone. And he asked me, "Are you writing?" "Yeah." And "Yes, but I'm writing shit all the time." And his usual one answer was, "Oh, okay, I'm happy with that, because if you said to me it was writing beautiful things,
I'd be worried.
I'm sure they would be good." So we were together for years and years and years, and in the first very hard times, because almost nobody wanted all my books, nobody. And Tom must remember that. I said to him, "You're losing money with me, because nobody wants the books, anywhere, nobody." And I will never forget what Tom answered. He said, "Well, you know, we will conquer the world." Remember that, Tom? And we didn't conquer anything, because nobody wanted the books. Then slowly we started. We started by a translation in Random House in the United States, and by a small publisher in France, and little
when
by
did, little. When did Bourgois come on the scene?
Bourgois came later, because we had a second
because
book.
Because Bourgois is publisher in France, 10, 12 books.
And a great publisher.
A great, great publisher. And actually, the words of Bob Weil reminded me of a wonderful text that Bourgois wrote just weeks before dying about, you know that text, that I heard Michel Piccoli read it in Lyon this summer. Just such an extraordinary publisher, important. And you have about 10 or 12 books in French there published by him.
It's even more extraordinary when you think that he was dying of a cancer, and he knew he was dying, and he dictated that text during his last weeks. And the first time he was operated, he was a very courageous man. And I said to his wife, "Dominique, your husband is a very courageous man." And she answered me, "No, he's elegant." So I understood that courage is one of the supreme form of elegance, and he was very brave and courageous. But Bourgois came in our way later, because we had a second book published by Albin Michel, I think. And and then Nabokov, Ivan Nabokov, told, because we are hesitating what publisher, and Ivan Nabokov told us that Bourgois was best publisher, so we went there, and I'm still there. And now Christian will always be alive because a great publisher, because his work is there.
Well, he talks about his collection as his autobiography in some way. It's the 4,000 books he has published is his life.
Yes.
And the choices that someone such as Bob Weil makes at Norton are also so important, because they bring us people such as yourself here. And it is very, in this particular atmosphere we live in, though I'm an optimist by nature and don't drink Drano in the morning, elegance is rather rare.
Bob is a very modest man, but he's an artist, because a great publisher is an artist. And it's first time we meet. We knew by telephone. We talked sometimes on telephone. And since the beginning, I admire several things in him. The cleverness and the nose.
The schnapps, capacity, we say here in New York, yes.
And the understanding of the work of art.
We must stop now, because I'm seeing him looking rather embarrassed, which I very much understand. Oscar Wilde once said, and I know you quite like this line, "I am modest, but I understand Oscar Wilde, when asked which were the 10 books of the century, he answered by saying that the question was rather embarrassing to him, as he had only written 4. You're surprised by this phone call you got in 1979, and I'm wondering how you deal actually with fame, with being known. You know, there's that wonderful line of Rainer Maria Rilke when he says that fame is the sum total of all misunderstandings that gather around a new name.
Yeah.
And And so I know you've said a few things about fame, and perhaps we could just start there, though we've started already.
You know, it's very curious. I receive lots of manuscripts of so-called young writers.
So-called?
Yeah, because all good writers are very young. Very young and very old at the same time, like Queen Nefertiti. But what they want me to do is to read them on Monday, say to them they are a genius on Tuesday, be published on Wednesday, and be famous on Friday.
And on television, on Thursday.
Yeah, they want fame, success, and so on. If you want to be a writer, you can't think about that. You can't. It's not important. If you are really a writer, the only important thing is to write. I start publishing late. I was 36. And it never crossed my mind to publish a book. I did the books and then threw them away. And it was very clear for me that I haven't found my voice. It's not this, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this. You know. And if I could come back, I wouldn't publish the first books. I wouldn't. They are not. It's still not what I want to do, you know? And so some books I didn't want them to be translated. And very late, it's only a very few years ago, I accepted that first and third book were translated. Because it was not yet what I wanted to do, you know? So, but you must be very humble in face of material, because you are still learning to write. To write is very, very difficult. I feel amazed when I go to libraries and see all those books. And I think, what a chance has a good book of a good author, a good young author, for example, to be read, you know, with all that enormous amount of books which are published, for example, in Portugal. It's incredible. It are incredibly bad. Incredibly bad. And it's some of them, for example, I know fine critics. And why do they write such bad books, you know? Because to write is so, so difficult. I'm still learning how to write. And even more it's difficult for me to write. Even more I understand that you must be... I'm not a modest man, but I'm humble. I hope I have a humble pride. But to write is really
a humble pride, you say.
Yes, of course. To write is... How can I say to you? I don't know what I'm doing. In the beginning, I wrote novels with a plan and so on. I gave the plan of a book, a very large book called Father Alexandrino. I don't know if it's published in America or not. It's published here.
Didn't know it was published.
I didn't know. I don't remember because there are so many publishing houses. And I gave the plan to Tom. So in the beginning, I worked with very detailed plans. Then little by little, I understood that if a book is really alive, it has his own life, his own character, even physically. For me, it's a living body, you know. So,
well, this leads
you
us.
You must write what book wants.
Well, this not, you not must what, you, what want. You want. It's what it wants, not what you want.
Pardon?
It's what it wants, not what you want.
Yeah,
which would lead us quite naturally to asking you how you come upon your subject, and in this particular case, how you came upon the subject of this book.
Usually, I have no subject. I started the book 25 February this year. I came here with the manuscript, and every day I write, and now at hotel room. And when I finish a book, I stayed 3-4 months. I don't know what I'm going to do, and I even don't know if I'm able to do another book, because a book is kind of a gift. I mean, for me. So I decided in November or December, the 25 February. I don't know why 25 February. We'll start writing. And I started writing in the 25 February. I didn't know where I was going. I didn't know anything. I was as poor as a dead, because dead are very poor people. When I told that yesterday. When my granddad died, after the ceremony, when my grandmother came home with us, we're all family, she gave his watch to one, his pen, his clothes, so he had nothing. And I was thinking, when he comes back, he has nothing. No clothes, no watch, anything. So now I start without any plan, anything. and hoping that the book finds his way, like the water that you and shoots his way in the floor. It's the words that generate words.
So this is a book that you're working on now, that you're describing. The book you started on the 25th of February is a book you're working on now. Going backwards, I mean, truly, the Owl of Minerva takes its flight at dusk. Probably later on you can find out perhaps how you came upon something and how it worked. But in this particular case, with this new magnificent book, how did you happen upon the subject?
That one?
Yes. Well, where did the inspiration come?
Yeah.
How did the story come to you?
I don't believe in inspiration.
Okay.
There is no inspiration.
It's because what is wrong with the word inspiration?
It seems like a kind of a miracle. Inspiration maybe comes when you find your work job, your daily job. I start writing at 9 until 1 p.m., then between 2 p.m. and 8 p.m., then between 9 p.m. until midnight every day. At Saturday, I don't write. I write until 4 p.m. and then the next day, Sunday, I write again. It's a question of work. It's a question of work. I believe inspiration. Maybe I don't know what it is, but I don't understand why writing the same 10, 12 hours per day. Some days you write 3 lines, some days you, in very good days, you write half a page. And the problem is not to write, it's to rewrite, because first versions are always bad, because the distance between the emotion, what is in the paper, is enormous. So all your work is rewriting and correcting and correcting and correcting until those things, you know? Because...
Let me ask the question slightly differently about this book. Where did the story come from?
I don't tell stories. I write.
We're going to have quite a time together, you and I. I'm going to say story. You're going to say no stories. I'm going to use the word inspiration. You're going to tell me no inspiration. So a story is told here. Did it have an origin?
I'm not quite sure there is a story there. Because I am... All I want is... Today I was with an Italian journalist, and he said, well, you have characters, but you have no any story in your book. There are no story. And I wanted to correct him, but I think there are even not characters, there are voices.
Why didn't you correct him?
Because he was a clever man, because I liked him. And when I like someone, I'm totally partial. Totally partial. I'm not able to have... when I love someone, man or woman, or I like someone, I'm totally partial. They have only qualities. And I love to be like this. I'm very late in that. And I don't have time to hate anybody. So there are people I like and people who are indifferent to me. But I think that until now I maintained intact my capacity of admiration. And, what I wanted... I think that you're actually seeking out the nature of man and the anguish of the man in time and the dignity of human nature. Nature. I apologize for my English. That's what interests me. You want to put the whole life between the covers of a book. I don't want to be a naturalistic writer. I don't want to tell stories. There are lots of wonderful told stories. García Márquez, he's a wonderful writer, a wonderful narrator. And, for example, García Márquez and other writers, I love to read them, but I wouldn't like to write their books. You understand what I mean? I wouldn't like to write that. I prefer to try to work with things that are before the words. I mean, feelings, instincts, and so on, emotions.
Yes, and here in reading you and then reading also of your perhaps late love of Proust or really strong now love of Proust, I was reminded by these lines in Contre Sainte-Beuve. I don't know if you remember, the very opening of Contre Sainte-Beuve made me deeply think of you, and I'm going to read it to you and have you react to it, because what you're saying now is very co-substantial to what I was thinking. So tell me what your thoughts are. Every day I set less store on intellect. Every day I see more clearly that if the writer is to repossess himself of some sort of his impressions, get to something personal, that is, and to the only material of art, he must put aside the intellect. What intellect restores to us under the name of the past is not the past. In reality, as soon as each hour of one's life has died, it embodies itself in some material object, as do souls of the dead in certain folk stories, and hides there.
I remember what Céline said about Proust, il a une sorte de talent.
Il a une sorte de talent.
Une sorte de talent.
It's a kind of a talent.
Yeah. Kind of a time. But when you told about the story, for example, in great books there is no story. What's the, for example, the old man and sea? An old man who catches a fish, the other fish eats the fish.
Punto y aparte. That's it.
The old man and sea. Anna Karenina, a married woman who's a very boring marriage, she sleeps with another man. What's this? Is this a story? It's not a story. So to write is how to write. In a great book, you don't find that this is not a story at all.
I've never known anybody to make Anna Karenina so concise as you have. You know, in this country, we have we have notes that students read when they don't want to read. They should listen to you.
Yeah. What is the Odyssey? The story of the Odyssey is...
Of the Odyssey.
The Odyssey.
Yeah.
I'm coming home late. This is not a story.
What's the story of one of my favorite books that I've had reason to reread recently aloud? Is Bartleby the Scrivener.
It's
Bartleby the Scrivener.
Yeah, from Melville.
Yeah. That one is, I guess, easier. It's just a man who says, I prefer not to.
Yeah. This is wonderful. Wonderful.
Isn't
text.
It?
Wonderful text. For example, when you read Heart of Darkness... It's not a story. It's kind of those Russian dolls. One inside the other, inside the other, inside the other. It's incredible, technically. But we are not going to speak about technique. It's boring. But it's a job. Like, it had a technique, of course. But when you start reading Conrad, for example, first time I read him, I had the impression that was walking in the fog. I didn't understand anything.
Walking into the fog?
Yeah, I don't know. And suddenly everything is illuminated. You see everything. And we readers, to read is I love to read, because writing is not... I don't love to write, but I love to read. When I write, it's a sort of kind of mixed feelings. You suffer a lot. Of course you have moments of joy. In some moments, not with this book, in another book, I noticed suddenly that I was crying. And I was not sad, nor... It was the feeling of the mot juste. It was exactly that word. It was an extraordinary...
This was something that you were writing.
Yeah,
I was working. When you came upon formulation.
Yeah, suddenly I noticed that I had tears in my eyes. And was... Because it was the words... You know?
A silly question for you. How does that happen? How does that happen?
I don't know. In that day, my hand was very happy.
You know, it's Leonard Cohen, someone who I've very much loved, once said that if he knew where inspiration came from, he would go there more often.
Yeah. I was thinking about what Horatius, I don't know, Horace. Said in... Art Poetica, he said, I'm going to say it in French. Un beau désordre précédait la fureur artistique.
A beautiful disorder preceded by artistic furor.
Yeah. And he also said that if you want to be a writer, you must work 10 hours per day, 2 hours to write and 8 hours to correct. So, then you.
So here we are.
You didn't change. And when you think about that poet from a Syrian poem, 15,000 years before Christ, who wrote, "Everything is written, everything is written. What am I going to write to say? Everything is said." Of course everything is said, but people forget, so it's good to repeat it again. You know, that you know. Perhaps everything.
I had a professor of philosophy who began some of his books that way, Vladimir Yankelevich, someone who isn't very known in America, but he wrote a book about death, and he said there's nothing to write about death, and then he wrote 500 pages. Where are we? We're with Conrad. We might not talk about the influences, but the passions. Some of your passions are very American.
Yes.
Very American. Faulkner in particular.
Faulkner, there is no such thing as Faulkner for beginners. But everything. For example, Hemingway. You love him at... I loved him at 20. I hated him at 30. And I start loving him at 40 again. This is very well done. Because in Faulkner you see tout le revers du scénario.
How would you say that? What's behind the stage?
And the good book is written par derrière.
From behind.
Yeah. So it's like an egg. A good.
Komenov. I'm translating in the wrong language.
No, yeah. I was thinking. I had a very good friend, a Portuguese writer called José Cardoso Pires. He died 10 years ago. And when I finished Father Alexandrino, I wanted him to read, to make a kind of an editing, because in Portugal you don't have editors. And 2 or 3 months later, I asked him, "What do you think about the book?" And he said, "I don't know. I only read it twice. And when a book, for example, when you read The Death of Ivan Ilyich, which is a masterpiece in my poor opinion, every time you read it, it's a different book. And it's not a book about death. It's very strange. It's a book about life. There are no books about death. There are no books about life.
I'm fascinated by that very notion. When we read the obituaries in the newspaper, the death is only one sentence. We read somebody passing away, the only thing that really matters to us is the life. We have but a sentence.
Of course. Because death doesn't exist.
Because so Tolstoy is very important to you, in particular that book?
The Death of Ivan Ilyich. Oh, so many books were important. When you ask a writer, writer is a very important title. People do books. There are very few writers. But when you ask a writer for their influences, they say great names. It's not true. Writers are lying all the time. I start writing because of Flash Gordon, Mickey Mouse. That was the things I read when I was 5 years old. They were important books for me. Sandokan. They were important books. Captain Blood. So I start writing because of them. I don't care about Homer. I don't give a damn about Homer. I loved comics, so I start writing those. I start writing things I would like to read, and this remains the problem of a writer all over his life. He always writes the books he would like to read, and finally he doesn't read them because he wrote them. This is it's a very curious position.
You were talking about Faulkner not writing books for beginners. And you compared and contrasted him with
Hemingway. Of course, he's a very good writer.
No, I didn't say you didn't say so. I just said that you said that Faulkner is a writer who demands a certain amount of effort. Difficulty is.
I don't think so.
Okay, let me phrase this differently for you for a minute. I'd like to get to one point which I think is important in your books, and I think I would love to hear you talk about this, which is the relationship between taste and aging. Entre le goût et prendre de l'âge. What we love when we're young, and when we reread it as an older person, how our taste changes through time. And what we remain faithful to. Well, the relationship between aesthetics and aging is something that I think is quite rarely addressed and I think quite important.
You know, Paul, sometimes I think that we have the age with which we are born. I mean, some people are born with 30 years old, some people...
Thucydides said that some people are born with grey hair. Yeah. I remember that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So but I'm trying to figure out how that might I'm trying to see if this helps me out.
You must. How can I explain? If you really want to, an artist must keep all great artists say a certain virginity of the
eye,
and of the mind, of course. They are so naive. They are anything more stupid than a clever man.
You have said I don't really like intelligent writers. What I like a lot, as any curious person would, are accidents. I like writers who talk to us with their guts, avec leur trip, j'ai lu ça en français, like Victor Hugo and Montaigne.
Yeah, you know, for example, Nabokov. It's my opinion. He's a very good writer. But he irritates me all the time. Because I'm reading him and he's saying to me all the time, look how clever I am. Look how clever I am. Look how I do this. Look how I handle technique. Look. And it's the book who must be clever, not the author. I don't want the Nabokov saying to me, look how clever I am. You know what I mean? So, for example, Victor, you talked about Victor Hugo. Sometimes you look like stupid. Even Faulkner, sometimes. Isn't it? And, boy, it's so good what he does. So good that he does. In that period between 28 and 40, in 12 years, he made the world.
Let's go to your training as a psychiatrist and the fact that you've written that you still like the smell of hospitals. And you've said that you go to hospitals from time to time since 1985 so as not to feel that you yourself are going mad. What is it? I mean, it was a most amazing comment to have read that. What are you seeking on these journeys to the hospital? What do you do there when you go there? And is there such a big distinction in your mind between sanity and insanity?
Well, you know, I came from a family of doctors.
Yeah, your father.
My father's a professor at the university. I have two brothers who are doctors. Well, grandfather. Great-grandfather, uncles, and so on. So I'm the eldest son. My father had six boys. We are only boys in family. And when I was 14, he asked me what I want to do. I said, I want to be a writer. And he was a very democratic man. So he said, oh, it's a very good idea. So you are going to study medicine. more or less like this. And then he explained to me, if you really want to write, it's better to take a technical formation, so it will help you to structure your blah 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 blah. So
was he right?
Yeah, I was right. I wrote.
Was he right to
my father?
Yeah,
he wrote a lot of professional articles. And
was he right to tell you to go to medical school?
Because it was the Brazilian tradition of my family, because he was son of a Brazilian. He was, and but he tried to write. In the end of his life, he showed me short stories he wrote.
What I meant to say is, was he right to tell you to go to medical
Pardon?
School? Was he correct to tell you to go to medical school?
He was right. Now I agree with you. But you know, it was... I was saying that in the end of his life, he showed me a book. He never published it, of his short stories, and he asked me, "What do you think?" And I read it, and I said, "You want my opinion as a son or as a writer?"
Right.
I was a writer. But as a writer, your book is a shit. Which was true. Because he was not a creative man. He didn't have sense, any humor. It must be terrible to have sensibility and to not have the moyen d'expression.
The means to tell things, to express.
So I was 16 years old and I was very precocious. And I entered the Faculty of Medicine. And they gave me the anatomy. 4 kilos. In the kitchen of my mother, balance. And I said to my parents, I'm not going to put 4 kilos of anatomy in my head. I want to write. But they were very insistent. Because the first years in that time, when you studied medicine, it was corpse and corpse and corpse. I never have said a death. I never have seen a death. Because I was the eldest son of two eldest sons, my father and my mother. And my grandparents were on their 40s, so everybody was alive. That's where man in mustache in photographs. It was first time I saw a dead person, naked. And I said, I would not be able to enter in that room. Well, but after in fourth year, when you start being with patients, I mean people who are suffering, then I start liking it. I start liking it. And I understand, and when I finished that, then I went to London to make a training analysis, then I came back, I went to the war. And when I came from the war, I asked myself, well, now what am I going to do? Because I must earn my money, because I wrote, but I didn't publish anything. I was sometimes some months in a pediatric hospital, and they put me in a unity. I don't know if you say like that, of children in terminal cancers. There was there a small boy. I fell in love with that boy. He was so beautiful. A boy 5 years old, dying of leukemia, and he died. You know. When a grown person die, two persons came with Padiola, and they take him. But he was only a small boy of 4 years old. So a man came and l'a enroulé dans un drap,
wrapped him in a sheet,
and went with him. And I was in the door on the infirmary. It was a long corridor, and one of the feet of him was balancing. When the man was, and I said to myself, I'm going to write for this feat. And I think that still I do now. I'm writing for a feat of that boy who died 4 years old, and who didn't. So I'm a religious man, but I was so hungry with God. Why? Why those see little girls, little boys? 3-4 year old crying for morphine. Why? Bleeding. Why? So the only way I could help them was writing, because try to be the voice of the voiceless. You know? This is a great responsibility, because you must live for the others. You remember that letter that Van Gogh wrote to his brother saying, I suffer for a lot of bastards and so on, blah, 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 blah. So I have a great respect for artists because they justify us. You know, every new year on TV, I love to do that. The concert of the new year with house music.
In Vienna.
In Vienna.
Yeah.
It's such a victory over death. I look at that with tears in my eyes because it's such a victory over death.
You know, it's amazing you should say that because both of my parents are Viennese and left Vienna in 1938 to go to Haiti. They were one of the very few Jewish families that went to Haiti. There were 107 families there. And when I was 18 years old, I asked my father to take me back to Vienna, to his Vienna, and everything he indicated with his index finger had disappeared. So it was really a trip in absence. And after a week of doing this, I became more and more depressed because everything he would show me, the medical school that he went to was no longer the medical school. It was the best medical school, he told me, in 1938, except for Montpellier. Why Montpellier? I don't know. But he always says, except for Montpellier. So he would show me these various things. And after about a week, I said to him, and that's where it links to your story, I said to him, you know, Daddy, this is a pretty devastating, I probably didn't use that word, but it's pretty depressing to be seeing a city that no longer exists. And he said, I don't see it at all like that. I'm here to tell you the story. It's wonderful. We survived. We made it.
Yeah, so we must be faithful to that honor.
You speak about aging, you speak about childhood. You have this wonderful line about childhood that I adore, about going to see your parents. You say, whenever I go to have supper at my parents' house, I leave with my childhood stuck in my throat. That's from this extraordinary book that I highly encourage people to get in when it comes out in February or March of next year, called The Fat Man and Infinity and Other Writings, the Chronicas, which is the way I discovered you at first in French, in the Edition Bourgeois. I know that those books are very much read in France these days. I have so many questions, but one of them maybe we could go to your war years in Angola and how and if they still permeate your work. Is this where, in some sense, your sense of horror and loyalty and estrangement and marginalization originated? And to what extent was this a founding experience for you of your awareness as a writer?
Not as a writer, as a man, because I had a Ptolemaic conception of the world. I was the center. And in the war, I discovered I was only one boy.
How old were you when you went?
I spent 4 years in the army and 27 months in the war. But we are not going to talk about the war. There are no such... It's the more horrible thing in the world. Nobody wins a war. Everybody loses. And we had many deaths. And even now, with the other officers, because soldiers were between 18 and 20, the officers between 22, we were very, very young. We are sent to be dead. We are not going to talk to the war because it's impossible. It was too cruel, too violent, and we must respect the death, the boys who died there. It's some... You can't share that. I couldn't write a novel. Perhaps the most beautiful book about the war is that book by Stephen Crane, Red Badge of Courage. And he wasn't in that war. He had an experience after that, as you know, but it was not in that war. Because if you really was in the war, you can't write about it. You can't. And it changes you. it was important for me as a man, because suddenly I understood a very important thing for me. I was only a guy between other guys, and most of them were better than me. They were brave, they were courageous, because, you know, that was a very unfair and horrible and just unfair war. And most of the officers were against the war. But when we were there, we didn't discuss if the war was fair or unfair. We just want to survive. We just want to be alive the next day. Because the first year it was very, very violent. For example, Americans went to Vietnam, yeah, soldiers and so on, for a year. Every month they had a week in town. Our soldiers spent 27 months at least in a poor Vietnam. We had no food. The liberation movement was better armed than us. Much better armed than us. So we're not talking about that. But it changed me in that suddenly I understood that I was a nobody. I was only a man afflicted. I was afraid, of course. And then I understood that courage, to be brave, it's only not be afraid to be afraid. Because everybody was. Because anybody is prepared to death. Nobody is prepared to death. And same time, as an officer, I had two bodyguards. One of them was killed. It was a beautiful boy, blonde, blue eyes, very nice, with a fiancé who was very much in love. And I can't tell that because it's in the Judascus, published here south of Manuel. I must translate again that stuff. And when soldiers said to me, he's dead, I said, no, he's not dead. Put him in my bed. And he was there for almost 48 hours. I couldn't admit he's dead. He couldn't be dead. How a 20-year-old boy full of life could be dead that way? I can't speak about that because I wrote it. But experience like that changes you a lot. And you became even more humble. And what I was saying, to be alive is such a honor. And, you know, 18 months ago I was operated from a cancer. I went to the hospital and to make a colonoscopy. And I thought I had hemorrhoids. And when I wake up from colonoscopy, I ask, well, the hemorrhoids are over. You don't have hemorrhoids. What do I have? You have a cancer. It's such a surprise, you know? Such a surprise. I was in the middle of a book. And I asked the surgeon, who was a friend, I want you to operate me tomorrow. And she said, I don't know if I can operate you, because I don't know if you have metastasis. And if you have metastasis, I can't operate you. So we made a tomography, no metastasis, he operated me. But he said, you know, you can't have metastasis between the X-rays of the tomography. So I was a very lucky man. I think it's a nightmare which is over. But that fact also changed my life, because suddenly, you know, I had to make chemotherapy, what they call preventive chemotherapy and radiotherapy and so on. And this was in a public hospital. Lots of people. A TV set, nobody looked at TV. Reviews, nobody read reviews. Nobody talked with anybody. Everybody was alone in his island of solitude. And I remember a very old man, very poor, poorly dressed, coat, trousers, but full of stains. And he was no gravata on the
tomorrow. No tie.
No tie. And when they called him, he was going to die. He was very, very, and with that collar horrible column, and he walked to the guichet like a prince. Like a prince. And that man is much better than me. And I felt guilty because I thought, I'm going to live and they are going to die. So suddenly I was ashamed because I was going to live. It was the only time I had that feeling. I was ashamed because they were going to die and I was not going to die. I saw their girls, women, ladies with
wigs.
And in fact, they were crowns. They were queens. And the dignity and courage of those people. I don't like the word patient. They were kings and queens who were there. Because their dignity in suffering. I hope that when my time comes, I will face that with the great unknown. with that dignity, with that courage, with that beauty. You know? So, what's a writer? Is it the only thing we can do is what I told you, to write to say what they can say, to be their voice, to... I was thinking about that first verse from Keats in the Endymion, a thing of beauty is a joy forever. And to restore the dignity of man, our dignity and our victory over death. Before coming, I was reading a book I like with interviews of Mark Twain. I'm a great admirer of Mark Twain. And it's such a victory over death. Every good book, every good painting, it's a victory over death. And this is the main thing for me. Proust is a victory over death. La recherche du temps perdu. When they gave me the European Prize, there were music. They asked me what composer I wanted. I said Schubert. Schubert died at 29. It was a quatuor from Schubert. My God, it was such a victory of the dignity and of the man will prevail and will endure. And there are people like that, like Schubert, like Velázquez and so on and so on and so on. Like me, why not? Like every artist.
Like you know, just been rereading some of Büchner, Wojciech Büchner, who died at the age of 23. And before dying, the last work he composed was a dissertation on the nervous system of fish. It's just an extraordinary fact to learn that this play that then became this great opera of Alban Berg was written by a 20-something-year-old. When we were, just before coming on stage here, we visited the reading room of this library, and it was, you told me, your first visit here.
Yeah.
And you were rather silent throughout the visit and just looking at the reading room, and then you just said to me, you didn't say this is victory over death, you just said, this is paradise.
Of course. This is paradise.
Which might be a victory over death, too. But
for me, paradise is that there are... I think that in life there are only two important things.
Three.
Friendship, books, and women.
In that order?
Oh, the order is arbitrary. And now I can talk about it because my wife is there, so... But friendship is the most important thing in life. A man, my grandfather was not an illustrated man. I never saw him reading a book. But he said me several times, and he was right, a man without friends is nothing. And he was right, a man without friends is nothing. So the good thing about books, perhaps the best thing, is the known friends you make through them. You know? You make through them. Emily Bronte, she's my friend. Tsekhov, he's my friend, and so on, and so on, and so on.
Easier friends than some Pardon? Of the living ones.
Yeah. Yes. If you ask me what living writers do you like, Emily Bronte, she's alive for me.
Let me ask you that question again.
Pardon?
Let me ask you that question again.
Of course.
What living writers do you like? Is that, that's a very tough question for writers.
No. for me, these people are alive. And they will remain alive as long as I live. For example, the more... I'm going to answer your question.
You really don't need to.
The more extraordinary painting I know, in my opinion, is Las Meninas de Velázquez, from Velázquez. And the most incredible criticism and most perfect criticism of that painting was made by Théophile Gautier, the French writer of the 19th century. When he saw the painting, he said, "But where is the painting?" This is an extraordinary criticism. But
I didn't know that, but that really, you probably know that extraordinary text by Balzac, Le Chef d'œuvre inconnu.
Yeah.
It's completely consonant with that.
Yeah. And then when you think that he died at 49 with that, it's incredible what he did. But we are very far, answering very directly to your question. Far from 19th century, where you have 30 geniuses writing at the same time. In Russia, in France, in England, the United States. I mean, talking like that, Tolstoy, Gogol, Pushkin, and so on and so on. In England, the Bronte sister, three. Lewis Carroll, Dickens, Thackeray, Wilkie Collins, and so on. Here, Hawthorne, or author I have a very special respect, Melville, Whitman, Poe, and so on, and so on, and so on. Now, this is my opinion, if you have five very good writers all over the world, it's not bad. That's my personal opinion. I mean, very good writers. I mean, I knew, for example, there are many things that I'm grateful to Tom Colucci. One of them was the discovery of William Geddes, which I didn't know. In my opinion, he's a very, very good writer, and I don't agree at all with George Steiner, to whom I'm very grateful, because he always wrote about me in such wonderful terms, because he tried to destroy it completely, J.R. or Drake Cornish, I don't remember. American writers I like. I love the Diaries of Sean Shiva. I think it's beautiful. It's incredible. It's so, so good. So, so good. A good page of prose is where you hear the rain. He wrote that.
Say that again. Yeah, I didn't catch it either. A good page of...
Good page of prose, une bonne page de prose est une page où on entend la pluie.
Ah, une bonne page de a good page of prose is a page where you hear the rain.
I was saying that because I spent a very amusing week with Norman Mailer in Gothenburg in Sweden, and we always spoke French, and his French was horrible. Was horrible. Je vous aime parce que vous êtes juif. He to me. I love you because you're a Jew. And we always speak French. We have to make speeches, always in French. So the Swedish people really don't talk like that. It was very, very funny. And
But you did discover your Jewish background recently.
No. I knew that. My grandfather, the father of my father, you look at his face, a very Jewish face. His mother was Jew. And the name Lobo is a Jewish name. So I'm a cocktail of Brazilian, Portuguese, German, so on.
Bouillabaisse.
Yeah.
Brayton, you know, I was telling Brayton Breitenbach that I was going to have the pleasure of conversing with you, and he would have loved to come tonight, but doesn't have the gift of ubiquity, is doing something at the 92nd Street Y tonight. And he said to me that he sees the Portuguese as people of the wind.
People of?
People of the wind, du vent. And the wind is forever, but it also drives us mad, blows over the brink of the ocean. And he was wondering in what way you consider yourself as a Portuguese writer or as an African Portuguese.
Oh, you remember Hokusai, the painter?
Yeah. I was actually thinking about him before when you were saying that it will take you until the end to write, because he said that it will take us 150 years to paint the mountain.
Yeah.
I go to the mountain and I haven't yet arrived really at painting her.
At 80, he said, if God would give me 5 more years, I would become a painter. Oh, yeah. It's not an excuse, but I do my work the best I can. I'm quoting Matisse, more or less, when he said, I work every day the best I can, blah, 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 blah. I really don't know the opinion he had about himself as a painter. But he felt justified because he worked the harder he could and the best he could all his life. You remember that what Newton wrote to a friend, I don't know what posterity will think about me. I said that when they gave me the Jerusalem Prize. But in my opinion, he said, Newton, more or less like this, I was only a child playing in the shore, finding a stone, a more beautiful stone, and collecting it between the vast ocean of truth was intact in front of me. And he changed everything in our lives. Huh? He was the man who proved that the stone that falls and the moon that doesn't fall are the same phenomenon. So I think that you must look at yourself like that. That's the way I try to look at myself.
I think included in Brayton's question was a notion of how important Lisbon is for you as a setting.
Oh, it's my Jognapatofa. You must find a fictional territory, no? Like Hemingway, Chicago, like... It's a fictional territory, arbitrarily called Lisbon. I could call it in another way, because at the same time I was educated in not in the Portuguese way, in the way of Brazil, and of the north of Brazil, of the Amazonia, from where my father's family comes, you know. So it was a decalage between what was inside. We were near Lisbon in a farm, kind of a farm, a big house. So I thought that everybody who was blue-eyed. Because the only people I knew who had brown eyes were the servants. And it was a very self-centered family because north of Brazil is very conservative, very endogamic. So I always had a very strange relationship with Lisbon or the city or the country and so on. I don't have any nationalism inside me because it was in name of those big abstract substantive that they sent me to death. I mean, honor, country, patria, so on, glory. In name of that, my generation, and not only my generation, went sent to the war to die there. And it was not the generals, not politicians. It was small boys, innocent boys. And you remember what Saint-Exupéry said about the young soldier who died in the war. He said, c'est un peu dans chacun de ces hommes Mozart assassiné.
It's a bit in each one of those, in each one of them, Mozart assassinated.
Yeah.
In each one of those boys.
Yeah. I thought a lot about that.
How do you understand that?
Pardon?
How do you understand that sentence? Comment comprenez-vous cette phrase?
C'est un peu de chacun de ces hommes Mozart assassiné. parce que sont si pleines de promesses au regard de l'avenir.
Donc c'est une question de là. It's they are filled with hope and in some way.
Au regard de l'avenir.
We're back to that image of the foot in some way.
Yes.
I'd like to read something. I mean, there's so much to read, and just one little passage, and then we'll soon open it up to questions. In one of your chronicas, which will appear next year, entitled Museums, I very much enjoyed this beginning. They say that the painter Bonnard, they say that the painter Bonnard, briefcase under arm, used to visit the museums exhibiting his works. When the attendant wasn't looking, he would take a palette out of his briefcase and retouch the canvases. I like to think of the aging artist dressed like a bank clerk from the 1920s, wearing a bookkeeperly tie and hat and beard that in photographs looks fake. And who can say it wasn't? Secretly amending his work like a nervous child. On the very few occasions when I visited a museum, I've always harbored the absurd hope that I would find him there, glasses perched on his nose, correcting his paintings. Since I never did see him, I was almost always bored. In those places of contemplation and ecstasy, I'm more fascinated, I think, by the burglar alarms than I am by the pictures.
That's the way a small boy looked at it. Because very soon they took me to museums and so on, and it was a small boy, it was very boring. I was not prepared to that. For example, at 18, 19, when I saw Ingmar Bergman movies, for example, it was very boring for me. Now it moves me to tears, because our condition, we are always, all of us, we are there.
Well, this is the notion of aging, of certain things that strike you at a certain age and don't strike you. And as you age, they inhabit your intellectual, not your intellectual, your ability to comprehend them, to fall in love with them.
Yeah, I was immature a long, long time. I think that I started to be a man in the war, if I can say. I think I'm being very pretentious because I'm still. What I see when I look myself in the mirrors, it's a young man with which the dont l'enveloppe s'est usée.
The body has been used up. Enveloppe is not really body. It's how would you say? Yeah.
You look at that face because I always had that feeling, even though I was a child. It's not me. I'm different. That is not my own. It's very strange. I'm another one.
Je suis un autre.
Yeah. No, I'm very cultivated tonight because I was thinking about what Nerval, French poet, I like him very much, wrote behind his photographs, I am the other. We are always other people.
Well, you write in another chronica, Antonio 56 and a half, the things that we call circumstances, and that is quite simply what we allow life and people to do to us, obliged him to reflect ever more deeply upon himself. At 20, he thought time would resolve all his problems. At 50, he realized that time itself had become the problem. It's marvelous.
But in fact, we live in function of eternities. My mother, she lives eternities of 6 months, which are so big. I was saying that yesterday, but when Marie Antoinette said to them, only 1 minute, only 1 minute, and that minute, or when we ring in the morning, and you know, 5 minutes, 5 minutes more in bed, and those 5 minutes are eternal. So, what happened to me with cancer, and suddenly eternity was taken out from me, because you can't live without eternity. You can't. And a good doctor is someone who gives you again, gives you your eternity again. No matter what, because 10 years, you have 10 years or 20 years, they will never pass. They will never pass. Because perhaps years are very fast, but minutes are so slow. When you are in a dentist chair, for example. So time is the main problem when you write. How to deal with time. Proust did it beautifully. You remember the end of the La Recherche when suddenly he found all those people?
What, Thomas Mann in the Magic Mountain?
Yeah.
Thinking.
Thomas Mann is to Germany for my taste because I have a German grandmother.
Nobody's perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, to finish with a writer of who writes in German, there's a line I've always loved of Kafka. He said, "There is hope, but not for us."
That is very beautiful. I remember when I was in Romania to a prize, and during the communist dictatorship, people used to say, does life exist before death? Is there life before death? Yeah? This is the most horrible sentence I heard in my life. Before death.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have mics circulating around, and so please just raise your hand and we will pass it around to you, but please wait until the mic arrives. And if you can bring up the lights also.
One of the remarkable features of your novels is not only the treatment of Lisbon, mythical or real, but also the experience of being a European in the war, to be sure, but in Africa. Could you talk a little bit about the presence of Africa in so many of your novels and the experience, why it keeps returning, because it's clearly something you keep wishing to return to in your writing?
I'm sorry, sir, but with that microphone, your voice, okay. It seems to me that you are God in the in final judgment.
L'Afrique est toujours présente dans vos livres. C'est comme si vous aviez toujours envie de retourner vers l'Afrique. Pourquoi l'Afrique est toujours là, présente?
You think so? I don't know. But Angola was the most beautiful place where I was in my life, you know? I was in there in a horrible condition, but it was so beautiful, so sensuous. So the smells, the colors, everything, the people, the joy of the people, the music, the respect for the old people, the real democracy they have, real democracy. I'm speaking about democracy in the sense that Gore Vidal used it in his famous essay about democracy. It was a miracle for me. When I arrived there, I looked at the sky. I said, "What am I doing here? I don't know this sky with different stars and so on." And I never went back. But perhaps next year, I don't know. But for me, it was an unique experience. But at the same time, it was so many suffering. But, you know, I think that everything is returning to me. I mean, all my ages, all my days, all my yesterdays, as Shakespeare said, and Edward G. Robinson used that, the title of his autobiography. which is splendid. All my yesterdays. So all my yesterdays, they come to me. And Africa, of course.
I read you primarily as a very political writer, and one of the things I read you for and read in you is what the act of colonizing does to the colonizer. I mean, I come from India. I grew up in a place not too far from the last Portuguese colony in India. And one of the things that I picked up quite remarkably and what I see in you is you're very flexible in the way you depict it, what it does to the body of not a nation, but in its inhabitants, like in Acts of the Damned or in bits and pieces of, you know, Father Exadrino.
And what happens, what the
the act of colonizing does to the colonizer.
What the act of colonization does to the colonizer. Le rôle de la colonisation pour celui qui colonise.
I don't understand.
What colonization does to the colonizer. Ce que, comment dirais-je ça en français, ce qui arrive au colonisateur quand il est colonisé.
You know, I...
colonise.
I understand. I think that... I don't like to talk about countries, my country now, but I think that Portugal is the least racist country I know.
The least?
Not racist because we are too poor. We are too poor. And the relationship because the between all those countries who speak Portuguese in Africa is... I have an Angolan passport, I wanted to give it, they gave it to me. There's no hate. It's which is fantastic. There's no hate, and if you go there, you see African people everywhere. So the relations are. But at the same time, I don't think I would be so generous. I would hate. In me, I would hate the colonizer. I would hate. But the liberation movements, they always had a very clear position because we heard them in the radio every day. Saying to us, we are not fighting against you. We are fighting against a regime who is trying to destroy all of us. We are all victims of that regime. We are not against you. So they made a very clear distinction between the politicians who led the country and the people. And the liberation movements always did that. It was very important. It was very important after the war. So I never had the feeling of being a colonizer. I always had the feeling that I don't know why I was there because, you know, dictatorship began in 26, finished in 74. I was born under that thing. From time to time it appeared in newspapers, things like... the political police put in jail, I don't know how many communists and other Democrats. It was like that. And the word democracy was... everything was forbidden. Everything. And I was born in that. I understood what democracy meant with La Fontaine. Because when I read the fable... where he said that a dog can look at the bishop. I was so surprised, you can't imagine, because it was the bishops who could look at the dogs. I mean, in that country, you know. And you didn't have a passport to go abroad. You must go to the political police. They could give it or not. And you must give an amount of money and only to very few countries, so only rich people could travel. We lived cut from the rest of the world. So we were born under that, and people were afraid of talking politics, even in family, because they didn't know who was going to tell the political police. Could be your sister, your mother, your wife, your husband. So, you know. And which was more strange for us, who were born under this regime, that was very natural. many, many books were apprehended by the political police, which was very stupid. There is a famous story that once the political police entered in the library and took Stalin, Lenin, and Racine. So it was a very stupid political police, as all political police. And after the revolution, that is always happened, all those people were recuperated by the information services, like the American did in Germany after the Second World War, and so on and so on and so on. It's so funny because those cruel assassins and so on, they went several months in jail and then released. And perhaps they are there, and they are there working, we know. This is very funny. This is very funny. I don't understand that, but it's very funny. And it happened in East Germany, same thing. And it happened after the Second World War with with winners, I mean, the Allies did. So, I was saying that I received a decoration from Mitterrand, French president. And I admired him before knowing him. He was a small man. He doesn't look you at you in the eyes, never, never. And comparing him to the Gaulle, he said, I was a very unlucky man. I didn't have a war. See? So it seems to me they are all the same. All the same. They love humanity. They don't love person. They don't love people. Oh, of course, every 4 years, they kiss boys and so on. Democracy is liberty to vote. I mean, in Europe, where I live, if Portugal is not Europe, it's a very strange place. But that's the only liberty you have. That's the only liberty you have.
I have a question. I share your love of Schubert, and I wonder if you share my love of Chekhov.
I can't. She shares your love of Schubert. Do you share her love of Chekhov?
Of course. You know, he's an extraordinary writer. That's one of my favorites. Because, you know, when you read his theater, his theater that amazes me. He uses sentence like, it's cold today, tomorrow we are going, all common words. And with this apparent, these words so common, so simple, so he recreates, it's all the world is there, all of our feelings are there with such simple sentences. But if I had to choose one play, my favorite play is not a Chekhov play, my favorite play is by Eugene O'Neill, Long Day's Journey into the Night. That's, for me, I love that play. But of course, I have a great admirer of Chekhov. Of course.
I wonder, you've spoken a lot about American and French and Russian writers, but who are the Portuguese language writers, living or dead, who you like to read now?
Qui sont les écrivains? Vous avez parlé beaucoup des écrivains français et américains. Et autres, mais quels sont les écrivains portugais que vous aimez, vivants ou morts?
Many. But the problem is that they are not known. Because...
You can help.
And I even don't know if they are translated, you know?
You can still help. We have Bob Weil here.
We have... Great, great poets. We always had great, great poets. I think it's our way of expression. Camões and so on, lots of them, lots. Even now, I can't tell you the name of 15 very good poets writing now. I don't find more than two or three good prose fictions writers. I'm not saying names because if you when you say a name, you're always excluding the others, and you have the tendency to love the people who belong to your family. I mean, your literary family, who in a certain way prolonge your taste and so on. I'm very partial in my opinions. You can't. I'm not a reliable guy when I say what I like or not, because I confound, I mix my.
But we don't have reliable guides.
I mix my passions and my ideas, you know?
Not such a bad thing.
Pardon?
Not such a bad thing.
Yeah. So I only can speak with passion. I'm sure there are very good. Must have now writing some young writers, because as I believe that there are writers from the African countries who speak Portuguese, which are good. But the only judge will be time. I don't know. And it's very difficult, because when you know a man and you read his books become different because you know him. I remember when I knew Jorge Amado, and we were close friends in the time of your life. Remember that photograph we had in Paris with Jorge and Sabato? I loved Jorge. I think he was better than his books. He was an incredible man. So, as I loved him, I tend to love his books, you know? And, for example, to read a book written by a friend, it's a very dangerous experience, because I'm always afraid. Because he must... It's like trapezio, an artist on the circus. He must leave one to catch the other. And he can fall. I'm always... He did it. So to read something, a writer, a friend or a writer you love writes, it's always very, very difficult. Because I don't want them to make a bad book. I don't want them. Because, you know, good books are like tigers. They don't kill between themselves. So I don't understand envy or jealousy. I don't understand that, because the good books, it's always a joy to discover a good book. It's only the pleasure of reading is one of the greatest pleasures I have. I always had in my life. Always.
Thank you very much.